All right, we are finishing up 2 Samuel 13 before we get into the next chapter. This is the section where Absalom kills Amnon. And, you know, they'd had a feast, and that's when it took place. And then down about verse 30, the king's sons, remember, had fled, and we had talked about that. Then in verse 30 it says, "And it came to pass while they were on the way that news came to David, saying, Absalom has killed all the king's sons, and not one of them is left. So the king arose and tore his garments, lay on the ground. All his servants stood by with their clothes torn." It's another one of those examples of how distorted the truth can become in a very short period of time. And that's, of course, exactly what had happened there. All the king's sons had not been killed by Absalom, but that was the news when it got to David. That's how it had gotten changed or twisted during that time. So, it says in verse 31, "So the king arose and tore his garments, lay on the ground, and all his servants stood by with their clothes torn. Then Jonadab, the son of Shimeah, David's brother, answered and said, Let not my lord suppose they have killed all the young men, the king's sons, for only Amnon is dead. For by the command of Absalom, this has been determined from the day that he forced his sister Tamar. Now therefore, let not my lord the king take the thing to his heart to think that all the king's sons are dead, for only Amnon is dead." So there the truth was actually told to David, so he did know that there was only one that had been killed. And so Absalom fled, and the young man who was keeping watch lifted his eyes and looked, and there many people were coming from the road on the hillside behind him. And Jonadab said to the king, "Look, the king's sons are coming, as your servant said, so it is." So it was, as soon as he had finished speaking, that the king's sons indeed came, and they lifted up their voice and wept. Also the king and all his servants wept very bitterly. But Absalom fled and went to Talmai, the son of Ammihud, king of Geshur, and David mourned for his son every day. So Absalom fled and went to Geshur and was there 3 years. And King David longed to go to Absalom, for he had been comforted concerning Amnon because he was dead. So Absalom, after this happens, of course, it says, and he flees and goes to this land, the king of Geshur. Why does he go there? Seems like an odd place to go. Why does he go there, of all places?
Is that one of the cities that he'd go directly
over? Oh, city of refuge? No, I don't think it was one of the cities of refuge. I'm not positive about that, but that's where his grandfather lived, wasn't it? His grandfather was there. So he was running back to Papaw, basically, was what he was doing. He was running back there. He thought it would be a safe place to be in Grandpa's house. And it says Absalom was there 3 years, but David longed to go to him, because he had been comforted concerning Amnon, since Amnon was dead. So what kept David from going to see Absalom during this whole time? I mean, what kept him from he was the king, he could go anywhere he wanted. Why didn't he just go there? Any possibilities? Okay. That's a possibility. I mean, it doesn't say, so whatever it is, you know, we're just kind of trying to put ourselves in David's shoes. And it may have just been plain old pride. That may have been the obstacle that kept him from going. It's really hard to say, and it may have been a combination of reasons as to why he didn't go. But it says he longed to go to him, but he chose not to.
Do you think he blamed him? Or did he try to get him to letting go.
And that could be, there's different possibilities. It's really hard, to nail one down and saying, oh, well, this is the absolute reason. When there might have been a lot of things going on in David's mind, and then, you know, when it doesn't tell us what's going on in his mind, it is, you know, just kind of an assumption on our part. But it does lead to other things, and that's why I kind of brought it up. It does lead to things that happens in this next chapter that are that teaches some great lessons. I think chapter 14 teaches some tremendous lessons about ways to go about reconciliation and ways not to go about it. So it says, beginning in chapter 14, so Joab the son of Zeruiah perceived that the king's heart was concerned about Absalom. Depending on what translation you have, you might have several different phrases there. Some say that his heart was toward Absalom. Some translations say it's against Absalom. It's because the Hebrew word is very nebulous. It basically just means that his mind was on Absalom. It doesn't say good or bad. So the translators have to, you know, I like the New King James because it just says concerned, and that's what he was. It doesn't say whether he was against him or for him. That's not what the Hebrew word means at all. The Hebrew word means just he has his mind on Absalom. And we see, you know, what's going to happen because of it. And Joab plays a big part in this. And, of course, he's played a part in lots of stuff in the past that's happened. This isn't the first thing. Remember, that's David's nephew, so it's a close family relative that we're talking about. The commander of the army. So he was the chief in charge of that. And he's the one that killed Abner way back in chapter 3. So, it says he saw that the king's heart was concerned about Absalom. So he, I guess you would say, hatches a plan. And he's we've already seen in the past what kind of mind this guy has. Okay, he's a schemer. He thinks of different plans and schemes and ways to get certain ends. And that's what he does here. This one is pretty ingenious in some ways, what his idea is to do. So would someone read the next two verses, verses 2 and 3 for us? Verses 2 and 3.
Joab sent to Tekoa and brought from there a wise woman and said to her, please pretend to be a mourner and put on mourning apparel. Do not anoint yourself with oil, but act like a woman who has been mourning a long time for the dead. Go to the king and speak to him in this manner. So Joab put words in her mouth.
Okay, so we get this, the beginning of the plot right here. So he's got this an idea. This is how I'm going to get David to do what I want about Absalom. And so he gets this woman from Tekoa, and that's where Amos the prophet is from. Of course, that's down the road. But and he's basically coaching her to tell a story. Okay, this is the story I want you to tell. And, of course, he has a purpose for the story. But he says, not only do I want you to tell this story, I want you to act in a certain way, too. So not only was he telling her what to say, he was telling her how to act as well. And he wanted her to act like someone who is mourning the dead. And act like you've been mourning for a long time. On top of that, not just mourning for a short time, mourning for a long time. And he chose a wise woman. The word wise there is not the typical word that we think for someone that's filled with wisdom. The word can be translated crafty, what were some of the other ones? Wily, subtle, shrewd, crafty. That's the kind of woman she was. Okay? So she would make a good actress. And apparently he knew that. So that's the kind of person he chose, is someone that could pull it off. Okay. So again, we're seeing what kind of person Joab is. And when you go to the king, you speak to him this way. See, it's all about coaching her to do just exactly the things that he wants. And because, you know, she's supposed to be in mourning and she's going to tell him these words and so forth. So she's trying to get the pity side from David. I mean, that's what she's doing. She's trying to get pity from David. And so Joab is telling her what to say and what to do so that she will get pity from David. And, of course, it works because beginning in verse 4, when the woman of Tekoa spoke to the king, she fell on her face to the ground and prostrated herself and said, "Help, O king." So she begins, as soon as she sees him, you know, here it starts, and she gets on the ground and she's saying, "Help, you know, I need help." And then the king said to her, "What troubles you?" You know, what's wrong? Obviously, he wants to know. "Indeed, I'm a widow. My husband is dead." Well, there's the first thing that she's bringing out. Okay, so she's trying to get again the pity from David. "Well, I'm a widow. My husband is dead." So there's the first thing that hopefully I'm going to get some pity from David about is because of that. Then, "Now your maidservant had two sons, and the two fought with each other in the field, and there was no one to part them, but the one struck the other and killed him." Well, now something else to try and get pity from him. "Well, I had two sons, one killed the other." So one is a murderer, I mean, basically is what she's saying, and the other one is dead. So see, she's really racking up the points to get pity from David, to get help from David. And she's doing it in a pretty amazing way. And so the whole family has risen up against your maidservant, and they said, "Deliver him who struck his brother, that we may execute him for the life of his brother whom he killed, and we will destroy the heir also, so they would distinguish my ember that is left and leave to my husband neither name nor remnant on the earth." So she says, this is, you know, my whole family is against me because they want me to have the murderer killed. And, of course, that would leave her, you know, basically without anybody. So you notice all the things she has brought up here, you know, to be without a husband or a son, you know, in that society would be considered a terrible, terrible misfortune. Because you always wanted at least one, you know, a husband or a son. And basically she was saying, I don't want to be left without anybody to take care of me. So she's, you know, her husband is dead. One of her two sons is dead. The other one may get killed, so help me. You know, I need this. Of course, none of it's true. This is all a, you know, a fabrication, just for Joab to try and prove a point for David. So the king said to the woman, "Go to your house, and I will give orders concerning you." Well, that wasn't good enough. That wasn't good enough. She needed an immediate response. And that sounded like David was kind of putting things off a little bit too much for her. So the woman of Tekoa said to the king, "My lord, O king, let the iniquity be on me and on my father's house, and the king and his throne be guiltless." Now again, she's trying to get more from him. And it's interesting, what did David not do? Yeah, exactly. He didn't find witnesses. He didn't go to find evidence. Nothing. Which he should have done. I mean, that was his job. He was the main civil ruler. And he didn't do any of that. He took all of one side of the story, assumed it was all completely true, which was what they were trying to get. And he didn't do any type of investigation of any of the facts whatsoever. And so she's basically saying, you know, I'll take the blame for it so that you'll be guiltless, so that there won't be any blame on you. No one will be able to criticize you. So again, she's trying to do everything with this story that she's been coached about to get David to make this particular response. So the king said, well, whoever says anything to you, bring him to me, and he shall not touch you anymore. David says, all right, I'll take care of it. No one will do anything to you. So he took the story hook, line, and sinker, every bit of it. He was just sucked right into it. Then she said, please, let the king remember the Lord your God and do not permit the avenger of blood to destroy any more, lest they destroy my son. And he said, as the Lord lives, not one hair of your son shall fall to the ground. So she's wanting, basically, you know, David to make an oath to protect. And, of course, revenger of blood, those were the ones, the family members, who would take vengeance on someone who was killed in the family. And that was goes back to the cities of refuge that was brought up a while ago. There were three on the west side and three on the east side that had been chosen a long time ago. So she says, please don't let that happen. And so David says, I'm going to give you all the protection that you could possibly need so that it's not one hair of your son would fall to the ground. So now the whole scheme is going to be shown why Joab did this in the first place. Right or wrong, we learn a lot about, again, about Joab and about what he's thinking. So the woman said, please let your maidservant speak another word to my lord the king. And he said, say on. So the woman said, why then have you schemed such a thing against the people of God? For the king speaks this thing as one who is guilty, in that the king does not bring his banished one home again. Now it's all starting to surface as to why she told this account. She's basically saying, you let my son off the hook, whereas Absalom, you're keeping banished from coming back home. So why are you doing this? Says you're basically guilty. For the king speaks this thing as one who is guilty. For we will surely die and become like water spilled on the ground, which cannot be gathered up again. Yet God does not take away a life, but he devises means so that his banished ones are not expelled from him. What is she trying to say in verse 14? It's kind of a drawn out explanation, but what's she trying to get across? I mean, I guess the first part's pretty obvious. We're all going to die. And once we die, that's it. You can't do any more. In other words, all your relationships on earth and so forth are done. You can't fix anything once you're dead. And I think that is certainly something everybody needs to think about. I'm not sure that's the most important point in this account, but it is something that she's saying. It says, you know, once we're gone, we're like water on the ground, and it can't be raised back up. In other words, once we die, we die. There's no coming back on this earth. It's over for us. And then the last part, though, he devises means so that his banished ones are not expelled from him. What do you think she's trying to get David to see in that particular part?
Redemption.
Okay, redemption. Reconciliation, whatever we might want to call it. I think that's exactly what she's trying to say. Whether Absalom should have been shown compassion is a different story. But what she is trying to say is David, in this story that I told you, you showed compassion on my son who was guilty of murder. So why are you not showing the same compassion to your own son, Absalom? And again, this is not justifying either one of those cases as to whether they should be shown compassion. But her point is, if you saw it in my story, why don't you see it in your own life? Why can't you see it in your own life? So therefore I've come to speak of this thing to my lord the king, because the people have made me afraid. And your maidservant said, I will now speak to the king. It may be that the king will perform the request of his maidservant. For the king will hear and deliver his maidservant from the hand of the man who would destroy me and my son together from the inheritance of God. Your maidservant said, the word of my lord the king will now be comforting, for as the angel of God, so is my lord the king in discerning good and evil. And may the Lord your God be with you. Then the king answered and said to the woman, please do not hide from me anything that I ask you. And the woman said, please let my lord the king speak. Now David is starting to understand, isn't he? He's starting to see that this whole story wasn't about this woman's two sons. There was an ulterior motive, all right? There was a reason why all this was done. So his question is the hand of Joab with you in all this? Is Joab behind all this? Did Joab tell you to dress this way? Did Joab tell you to make this story? Did Joab tell you to come and do this and say that? Is Joab behind all this? And the woman answered and said, as you live, my lord the king, no one can turn to the right hand or to the left from anything that my lord the king has spoken. For your servant Joab commanded me, and he put all these words in the mouth of your maidservant. To bring about this change of affairs, your servant Joab has done this thing. But my lord is wise, according to the wisdom of the angel of God, to know everything that is in the earth. And that's probably a pretty good place to stop. She says, yes, Joab is behind it. He put all these words in my mouth, and the reason he did it is to bring about this change of affairs. And Joab may have had some ulterior motives as well behind wanting David and Absalom to be reconciled. But Lord willing, we'll talk more about the reconciliation part next week when we look at the second half of this chapter.